This podcast features criminologists discussing sensitive themes and topics. Listener discretion is advised. A teenage girl sneaks out of her bedroom window in the middle of the night and calls 911. What law enforcement finds behind the front door is a house of horrors. This is the Jordan Turpin story. Hello, Amy, and hello, listeners.
Hi, Megan.
Today's case is one that reminds us all that you never know what is going on behind closed doors. Domestic abusers are very skilled at hiding their crimes, as I discuss in some of my courses, and you might as well, Amy, but one of the reasons domestic violence is so difficult to detect is because it often does happen behind closed doors where it's not visible to us. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, in direct contrast to street crimes, which we can often see, mm-hmm. right? Literally, we can see them. So for domestic violence, it's hidden. There's often not many witnesses, and it can be hard to prove. And unfortunately, children are the most vulnerable in these scenarios. For those supporters who have memberships with us on Patreon, you might think this case sounds familiar to the Hart family story. And you would be right. There are similarities between the two cases. For now, let's meet the hero in our story today, Jordan Turpin. On a quiet street in the California suburb of Paris, a neighbor's surveillance camera caught a teenage girl exiting the window of her house around 5:49 a.m. on January 14th, 2018. The camera shows the girl running quickly down the driveway of her home and then running down the street. This teenager was 17-year-old Jordan Turpin, though from the footage, Amy, she looks much younger. Jordan had a cell phone with her and she quickly used it calling 911, but she had trouble speaking. Her voice was shaking and the operator could tell that she was clearly terrified. Now, Jordan told the operator her home address based off a slip of paper she'd found in her backpack. It was something she had grabbed on her way out of her window. But it turned out that it wasn't the full address. It was just a zip code. And when the operator asked Jordan why she didn't know her home address, Jordan replied it was because she'd never been allowed outside of the home.
Wow.
She went on to shakily explain that she was running away because she and her 12 siblings had, quote, abusing parents. So abusive parents is what she meant, but I don't think she knew the exact terminology. Mm-hmm. The 911 operator skillfully kept Jordan talking while she waited for the police to respond, getting as much information as she could. So here's what Jordan revealed. She told the operator that her parents hit her and her siblings on a regular basis, pulled their hair out, choked them, and shockingly, that two of her sisters were currently chained up in the house right now. In fact, she said they were chained to their beds.
What was the age range of these children?
They ranged from very young, I think about 3 or 4 years old, all the way up to adult children in their late 20s.
Okay.
Now, as the operator kept Jordan on the line, police were able to track her by the cell phone. And at the direction of the 911 operator, Jordan stood under a stop sign so that she would be visible to the police. Jordan told the operator that she was afraid her parents would see her outside, but the operator kept her talking, getting the names and ages of her 12 siblings and other information until the police arrived. It was only a couple of minutes, too, before a deputy pulled up. But Jordan had never spoken with a stranger before, let alone a police officer, Amy, and while she tried to explain how much danger she and her siblings were in, her vocabulary was very limited. And the deputy had a hard time making sense of her story at first. But Jordan cleverly had pictures of her situation on this cell phone that she had. Mm. Now, it was unclear at this time, just so you know, how she had this cell phone.
I was just going to ask if her, if her parents were so abusive, it's odd to me that she would have a cell phone.
It's not actually her cell phone.
Okay.
And it was the only cell phone, I believe, in distribution in their house. And I believe it was one of the adult children's phones mm-hmm. that was either discarded by a parent or this child got a hold of secretly. And then Jordan got a hold of it. So the children did not have cell phones. This was one phone. It was a rarity. And I believe also, just so you know, this was a flip phone. So an older phone. Mm-hmm. But what Jordan had on this phone and what she showed the deputies were pictures of her two sisters chained up, just as she said, filthy, dirty. And I mean really filthy, Amy. Obviously malnourished and so pale, like they hadn't seen sunlight in years. It was very disturbing. And you can see this whole thing on film if anyone would like to see. The surveillance footage is posted online and is publicly available. An hour and a half later, at about 7:20 a.m., after obtaining a lot of information from Jordan, the deputy, along with some backup officers, went up to the door of Jordan's house to conduct a welfare check. But they had no idea what they were about to find. Before we get to the search, I just want to point out that Perris, California is quite a lovely suburb. It's certainly not the place you'd expect to find what was behind this front door. But then again, awful crimes can happen anywhere. And these deputies were about to find that out as they knocked on the front door of the Turpin house. Now, it was early in the morning, as I said, about 7:20 a.m. It took 2 minutes for David and Louise Turpin, seemingly very surprised, to open the door. They told the officers that they had been in bed sleeping, though, as it was early, and demanded to know what this was all about. And when the deputy said that they had been sent to conduct a welfare check, the Turpins reluctantly allowed the officers in. As the officers came through the door, you can also see all of this, by the way. As they came through the door, Louise acted very nervous, asking what kind of call the officers received to bring them to the home for a welfare check. The deputies didn't quite answer. They kept it loose. They said they received a call from a young female that the children might be in some danger in the home. And I'll tell you that they moved through a scene that was absolutely horrifying. Their body cameras documenting all of what I'm about to describe. The house was a hoard with clutter, decaying food, and trash that filled every room from top to bottom. So there was no floor space whatsoever, no counter space, nothing. And there were dirty children sitting in this mess. The windows were all closed and it was hot, which intensified the smell of decaying food and trash. They did not have air conditioning working. No. Can you imagine?
No.
Yeah.
Can't.
As they searched the bedrooms, the deputies found two frail and filthy girls with bruises all over their arms. These were the girls from Jordan's photos. And although they were not in the chains as her photo showed, the bruises on their arms clearly matched where the chains were in the photos and indicated that they had been chained just prior to the arrival.
Where were the parents, meanwhile? Have they been detained at this point?
Nope. They are walking through the home kind of with the deputies. However, I will say the deputies were very skilled. One of them would walk through and the other kind of held the parents in like the front room, keeping them separated from the children.
Okay.
A second bedroom revealed several more badly emaciated and dirty children. They were very, very dirty. In a third bedroom, deputies found three boys, one of whom was actually shackled to his bed by wrists and ankles. And those chains that were probably on the girls, the deputies found them in the closets as well, likely being hidden there. At this point, the deputies had seen enough. So they were detaining them in one room at first, but they placed Louise and David Turpin under arrest for child endangerment. The children were literally freed from the chains that shackled them, and emergency services immediately brought them to the hospital to tend to their injuries and severe malnourishment. Just so you know, some of the children couldn't even walk. They were so badly malnourished. Their bones hadn't developed properly. At the hospital, it'll be the first time where these children received basic needs. They discussed getting food, getting macaroni and cheese. They were so excited. They were super excited to get baths and clean clothes. According to Jordan Turpin and some of her other siblings, they were only allowed to bathe once or twice a year.
I have so many questions, but I'm assuming we'll get to a lot more information. So I'm trying to just let you tell the story.
In fact, Amy, just so you know, there was a question about why they were shackled. The deputies had asked Jordan if he knew, and she said it was punishment because they stole. And he asks what they had stolen, and she said, well, food, but they were starving. This was punishment for eating. So who was this family, and how had this happened? Why would parents chain their own children up in their beds?
Megan, were they all the biological children of the parents?
Yes, they were all biological children of the Turpins.
Okay.
And now that you ask about them, let's talk about David and Louise Turpin. David and Louise met as teenagers in West Virginia, where they grew up. David was described as a bit of a socially awkward kid. Very smart, though. He went to Virginia Tech for engineering and obtained a very good job, following graduation in the field. Louise was a very religious young girl. She was 6 years David's junior and just 16 when they got married in the Pentecostal church. They were both very religious and had strict rules about lifestyle, and their belief about children was that they should have as many as God would allow. David and Louise moved to a nice home in Fort Worth, Texas, and began their family. Their first girl, Jennifer, was born when Louise was 20 years old. Jennifer remembers from her childhood, she's also interviewed, that her father had a temper. Even as a little girl, Jennifer could recall David yelling at her mother. She said that she could remember her father punching a hole in a wall. I don't think she recalled any type of physical abuse, hands-on direct from David to Louise, but certainly it did seem that he was abusive. And she said, in turn, her mother was also moody and could be verbally abusive to both Jennifer and her siblings. But it did seem that her father was mostly in charge of the rules of the home. What it appeared to Jennifer was that her father set the rules and her mother enforced them. The family quickly grew beyond Jennifer, expanding to 13 children between 1988 and 2010. And they led a very reclusive life, never having friends or any family to their home. And other than school at first, they didn't go many places. Now, Jennifer, the first sibling, says that she remembers going to school dirty because they weren't allowed to bathe often and their home was filthy. She talks a little bit about being in school, how she didn't have friends, how she was the dirty kid and people didn't want to sit with her. She was very, very thin. While I wouldn't say she looked completely emaciated or frail, she didn't quite look like a healthy kid either. When she was just 8 years old, her parents pulled her out of school and her siblings, and none of them ever got any type of public education again.
Were they homeschooled?
Well, that depends on what your version of homeschooling is, but I will get to that. Soon after, the family moved to rural Texas, where the children were even more isolated than before. At times, David and Louise, and this was earlier on, would abandon the children for a couple of days at a time, leaving them starving with very limited food and water. When they'd return, they'd rule over the children with intense physical abuse. When they were gone, too, just so you know, or when they left, they would threaten the children, telling them that if they called anyone, if they called child services or the police, that they would simply get in trouble and that they would be removed from the home and separated from each other, never allowed to see their siblings again.
So I'm assuming there's no extended family in the picture?
There were a couple of family members who had contact with David and Louise earlier on, but David and Louise shut them out. So we can talk about what our thoughts are when we get there, you know, about what they should maybe have done, should not have done, could have done, you know, without putting the blame on anyone else. Mm-hmm. The Turpins used their religious zealotry to justify their harsh corporal punishments, which included whipping their children with belts and locking them in dog crates as discipline. Nobody would come to the rescue of these children. And again, the Turpins would continually threaten them with separation if they called for help. In 2010, the family moved to the California suburb of Perris when David got a new job and a new fancy car. By the way, I should point out that Louise and David were always well bathed. Their hygiene was fine. And they also had possessions.
What did they do for work?
Louise stayed at home with the children and David worked in engineering. He had a pretty good job.
Okay.
The problem was Louise was also, well, among many problems, Louise was known to be a shopaholic. She spent tons of money on clothing, trinkets, games for herself. Get this, Amy, she bought games and children's clothing, but she never took the tags off and she would never give these items to her children. They had to wear the same ratty, ragged, ripped, smelling clothing that they always had. She had them. They took video of this. She had all this stuff on racks, on shelves. It was almost like an additional punishment or an additional, I would say, form of torture to these children. Mm. Now, the kids' diets were, as they said, basically they got bread and peanut butter. That was what the kids subsisted on while their parents ate whatever they wanted. A lot of takeout food, a lot of McDonald's, pizza, and other warm meals, which their parents made the children serve them when their children were starving.
Besides the fact that this is horrendous, this is the most bizarre case of child abuse that I've heard of.
It is one of the most bizarre cases, certainly, and rare. In 2011, David and Louise took the family out of the house, which was, for them, kind of exciting because they never left. They took them to Vegas to renew their vows in an elaborate event. Now, in the photos, which I encourage people to look at, they're seemingly happy. Well, David and Louise are very happy, and you can tell they're well-nourished, or at least well-fed, while their 13 emaciated children were paraded out in matching outfits for the event.
What?
You can see these children are very, very thin and very frail. The children could barely dance at the reception. Many of them looked too thin to be upright, but they were part of this momentous occasion, and they said they were just happy to have a bath because they were allowed to bathe finally and leave the home and, I think, eat. After which their parents went to a motel and celebrated their renewed union while the children were forced to go back home and essentially into these deplorable conditions. Though David and Louise had threatened their children not to tell anyone about their situation, Jordan, who was the second oldest girl, and the eldest Jennifer, who we've discussed earlier, knew that they had to get out. They also saw, as time progressed, Amy, they saw their siblings getting weaker and weaker, and they were concerned that some of them were not going to survive, and with good reason. In 2015, this is so interesting, Jordan saw something that she said changed her life. So remember the cell phone that she was able to get a hold of?
Yeah.
Or maybe she got a hold of a parent's one. I don't remember exactly, but she was able to access a cell phone and she found Justin Bieber on it.
What?
So, you know, he was a teenage star then and his music videos, he's putting a lot of music videos out. And I guess maybe this phone had some access to online activity. Mm-hmm. And so she got to see like Justin Bieber doing videos and singing. And he also made some videos like with his friends. He was being a normal kid, I think, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The videos were probably a little bit older. But Jordan said that like she saw this young guy doing these fun things. And she realized like she wanted to have a life. She wanted to have friends. She wanted to eat, to sing. She loves singing, by the way. So she also said that from Justin Bieber, she learned vocabulary and he inspired her to dream of an actual real life. The children were able to catch some snippets of television. So when their parents would go out, they would sneak television time, which I don't know how often that was, but I don't know that they were punished for that. The television was not locked up. Certainly, that was one of the things they could have access to very rarely. And I mean, Jordan just envisioned a life beyond. And so did some of the other kids seeing, you know, imagine that watching TV and seeing what other people were doing when you're trapped in this house and you're, oh gosh, mm-hmm. in such bad conditions. But for Jordan, this inspired her and she realized she had to get out of this house. She had to help her siblings. And so she began to hatch a plan with her older sister. They began drawing maps of what they thought the streets were like outside. They used that secret phone that they had gotten a hold of to call taxi cab companies to inquire about costs of travel. I don't know where they were thinking about going, but Jordan did say, uh-oh, it costs a lot of money that we didn't have. But they also took pictures. Remember all those photographs mm-hmm. that Jordan took? Because she said that she had seen something on a television show, like one of those crime shows, that if she wanted proof of what was going on, she'd need pictures. Pretty smart, right?
Yeah. It's amazing that she has the wherewithal to do all this when she is suffering such an extreme trauma.
Such an extreme trauma. And she was clearly emaciated as well, not eating. Mm-hmm. But she was older and felt like she had to help her younger siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And on January 13th of 2018, it had to happen. Jordan had overheard her parents talking about moving the family to Oklahoma the very next day. But Jordan said, my siblings, some of them were so badly emaciated and so frail that she was afraid they wouldn't survive the trip. So Jordan knew it was now or never. And in the early morning hours of January 14th, she escaped through her window and made that 911 call. Now, after their arrests, David and Louise Turpin were charged with multiple counts of torture, abuse of dependent adults, child abuse, and false imprisonment.
Now, did they turn on each other?
They did not turn on each other, no. It was ironic that both David and Louise, at least for me, ironic, and I appreciated this. In one scene, you could see them chained to their chairs in court. And I thought, great, their children are free, but yep. they are actually shackled to their chairs.
Yes.
Which gave me a warm and fuzzy feeling, unfortunately.
The symbolism. Yeah, yes. you can't go past that symbolism there.
Yes. Before the arraignment, Louise's lawyers had her mentally evaluated to see if there were any mental health factors that could be used to mitigate the charges against Louise as they prepared for trial. So psychiatrists diagnosed Louise with histrionic personality disorder, likely stemming from sexual abuse in her childhood. Histrionic disorder is usually characterized by unstable emotions, excessive dramatic behavior, and an excessive need to be noticed.
Did she report being sexually abused?
So she didn't report it when she was younger. However, I will say that it was corroborated by her sisters, who made public statements and said, in fact, Louise and her siblings had been sexually abused by someone very close to the family for years. Okay. The claim seemed credible. Mm-hmm. However, it didn't persuade the judge that this was a mitigating factor for the abuse that Louise had perpetrated on her children for all of these years. Mm-hmm. And between the body cam documentation from the welfare check and the testimony of the Turpin children, there was some very strong evidence on the side of the prosecution, Amy. Not willing to risk a trial, David and Louise pled guilty to the charges. And at the sentencing hearing, two of the eldest children testified. Joshua, who is the oldest boy, stated, "I cannot describe in words what we went through growing up." He details his growth, though, and how, even though he had a terrible childhood, he is a survivor now and trying to thrive in his new life. Mm-hmm. Jennifer gave a very powerful statement detailing what her parents took from her, but how she managed to take control of her life after being freed. A weeping David and Louise listen to the statements, opting to give their own as well. So David Turpin, crying, stated that he was praying for his children. He loves them and he always will.
Okay.
Louise said that she was sorry for hurting her children, who she loved so much, and she hoped that her children knew that she and David would be fine.
I don't think they cared.
I wonder, you know, what kind of mixed emotions they had. Jordan and Jennifer both stated that they did feel some sympathy for their parents, but mostly anger.
Yep.
And Jennifer added that no matter what, her parents are monsters.
Yeah.
No matter what the feelings are about them. After the statements were delivered, the judge pronounced a sentence of life for both David and Louise.
Is that with the possibility of parole?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I would imagine if it doesn't say life without possibility.
I would imagine so as well, because this was in conjunction with a deal.
Got it.
Despite this judicial outcome, there are so many questions, Amy, as to why and how this happened. But before I get to that part, I just want to briefly touch on how the children are doing post their parents' incarceration. Unfortunately, Amy, this isn't a happy story afterwards either. Jordan and her siblings were placed in foster care, but they did not receive the resources and help they so desperately needed and were entitled to.
How old was the oldest child?
The oldest child, Joshua, was in his 20s, and there were older children, but they were dependent and they did not have life skills. They couldn't function, okay. And they weren't physically in good shape as well either.
Got it.
Remember also, they were reared with these parents from a young age. This is the only life they knew. As feared, the children were separated because seven of them were minors. And while these seven children were placed in homes that were unsafe themselves with ongoing allegations of abuse, in which, get this, these minor children, after being subjected to all these years of abuse in their own home with the Turpins, reported physical and sexual abuse by their new guardians.
Oh, so awful.
This is so awful. The young adults, as you mentioned, who were in their teens to late 20s, did not receive housing or food because they were technically considered adult by the system, even though they had no resources, no education, no skills, and they were still essentially children for all purposes. They reported that they just did not receive any skills training. They couldn't get access to healthcare or housing, even though they tried. Jordan Turpin said on the record, she was doing an interview. So one of the sources here is that she did an interview with Diane Sawyer. Mm-hmm. And she said it was so sad during this interview that from day to day, she had no guarantee of food. Even more disturbing, I think, is that when the case hit the news, I don't know if you remember this, but it was extremely public.
Yeah.
And the public had raised over $600,000 for the Turpin children to be held in a trust to aid them with their recovery. But the children said that they can beg and make all the requests they want, but they are barely able to access these funds.
Why is that?
So the trust is private, and the public guardian who oversees the trust apparently turned down a lot of their requests. And when questioned about it, even like, you know, Diane Sawyer's team went in and they tried to, you know, when they tried to question them, they said that confidentiality prevents them from discussing this case, but there's an ongoing investigation. Mm-hmm. According to the older Turpin children, their guardian repeatedly failed to help them with just basic necessities, even with housing and even transportation, like bus passes. Also enraged the district attorney. Just so you know, the district attorney gave an interview and went public with his thoughts about the case, stating that the Turpin children were failed a second time, and he expressed his outrage about their re-victimization. Now, most recently, and after the publicity, the youngest children were moved into a stable home and eventually brought back together, thankfully. They currently have a lawsuit pending against Riverside County and the foster agency that placed them. But the adult siblings have been left to figure out a very new and adult world all on their own. Jennifer Turpin, the oldest girl, she lives on her own and works full-time, aspiring to work in the field of music and travel. And she hopes that her legacy, she's very, very well-spoken. She's very strong. Mm-hmm. She hopes that her legacy will not be one. She doesn't want to be remembered as a victim, but rather a survivor and one of strength. And I can certainly see that in her. Jordan Turpin, you know, we said the hero of our story, both Jordan and Jennifer. Mm-hmm. She's moved on with her life. She now lives, since that interview that she gave, she now lives in her own apartment. Mm-hmm. She has a dog, which of course we think are probably essentials to anyone's happiness, right?
Yes.
And she does have a modeling contract. She was interested in modeling and a limited clothing line. I don't know if you've seen her, but she's what I would call Instagram or TikTok famous. She has like almost 1 million followers.
What kind of content does she put out?
I think she sings and does like little dances and stuff. Uh-huh. And she says that she still cries on a regular basis and she still struggles to eat even due to the years of malnourishment that she suffered. So she still has even digestive issues, which I'm sure all the children do.
Are they very close? Jennifer and Jordan very close?
Yes, they are. Okay. And they're still close with their other siblings as well. Mm-hmm. She's a survivor by all accounts, but it's a very long road that she describes for her and for all of her siblings. Following the airing of their story, another inspiring woman pledged to raise money for the Turpin children as well. And this woman is none other than J.C. Duggard, a woman who went from kidnapping victim to survivor and began her own foundation to help other survivors and their families as well. So we have an update, and certainly we wish all of these children nothing but the best. I really do. They've had such a hard road, and I just hope that they finally get the assistance they need. And I hope that the trust and all the money that is supposed to be for their recovery is properly given to them with some guidance and help.
They also have the civil suits pending. Is that correct?
They do. That's correct. And okay. I would be so hopefully very, very surprised if they didn't win, to be honest. Mm-hmm. The question becomes, though, and the one that is probably still unanswered, is why? Why did this happen?
And how?
And how? Yes. So, Amy, I'm going to do my best here. And if at any time you want to chime in and help me out, that would be great because this is complicated. Now, the Turpins, David and Luis, were very abusive parents who perpetrated physical abuse such as hitting and choking. You heard whipping, things that were outright physically abusive. But more regularly, their abuse was focused on withholding food. Mm-hmm. So this chronic starvation, restricting their children's movements, shackling them, withholding access to bathing and other modalities of hygiene. So it's a little bit different, their mode of torture, you might say.
Did they also say degrading things to the children or did they show them any love? Like, what was the relationship like? Was it hot and cold or do we have that kind of information?
I don't believe their relationship was very close in terms of affection. I don't believe that was there because they viewed their role as being disciplinarians. Mm-hmm. Children must be disciplined. And they must not question authority. They must obey. So I don't believe there was much by way of any affection. And they withhold basic needs from them as this form of torture. So this type of abuse that they suffered is predicated on control, although we would probably argue that most abuse is centered around control. In this regard, though, Amy, the control is used to facilitate a strongly held ideological belief that children must be disciplined to be taught respect and authority. This was one of the basic foundations for David and Louise.
And is there a religious underpinning here?
Yes, there is. But I mean, you know, they were Pentecostal, and I have to be honest, I don't know much about the religion itself. Even if it's based on fundamental ideas of a strict, I know there was strictness in the way they were raised, and I know there was strictness in their own lives, discipline in their own lives. However, this is a case of abusing religion and using it as a justification when no religion would ever call for this type of practices.
No, of course not. But I was wondering if they tried to mitigate the harm by saying, you know, by blaming it on the religion. Although you and I and everyone listening both knows that's entirely false, but they did say that.
They absolutely did. And David Turpin had extreme religious beliefs. I believe he found a younger, submissive partner who deferred to David's beliefs as superior. And also, with every child and every submissive he had, I believe his authority grew in his own mind. David was not a sociable man. He didn't have much contact with outsiders. And it was likely because he didn't like people as well who didn't share his strict values, what he would call, and beliefs. He didn't trust outsiders. So I think that he derived his control and his sense of power from his children. And when faced with an outside threat, any outside threat of outsiders, whether it's school, a family member, they retreated into a world where they had sole domination and it became more and more isolated. So the problem is therefore exacerbated, Amy, when there are no external influence. There's no checks on authority.
There's no threat of informal sanctions for him.
Exactly.
You know, there's nobody that he's trying to, you know, put on a front for, or, you know, he has nobody to answer to.
Absolutely. Which, unfortunately, this type of isolation seems to facilitate the progression of violence that happened and the extreme nature of this violence. Now, in their instance, David had made decent money while Louise stayed at home, but Louise had an addiction to spending money on useless items that were not utilitarian. At one point, I read that her spending forced the family to declare bankruptcy. But rather than blame his wife, it appeared that the couple justified withholding further items from their children due to their precarious finances. So they saw their children as the stressor, the financial stressor, instead of blaming each other. They saw any slight infraction on behalf of the children as a challenge to authority, and the punishments grew more extreme. I think actually as David and Louise lost more control over their finances, their corporal punishment and torture towards their children became more extreme.
I'm surprised that none of the children had passed away from their injuries or malnutrition.
Very surprised. I believe Jordan Turpin said they were on the precipice of it. There were some very, very serious medical conditions in these children. This was a long, gradual process that escalated with time, with further isolation, with lack of interference. And it's an extreme form of abuse, one in which both parents were fully aware of what they were doing, regardless of their own justifications, religious or not. They're both responsible. In this case, it's only too bad the parents weren't stopped sooner and that it had to take the courage of one badly abused child to stop them. Today's case is not one in which I want to discuss the criminal justice system. When they were apprehended, yes, they were punished properly. I think we could probably agree. Although we might say that no punishment is enough for them. But today is one in which I'd like to discuss all the other institutions in society that failed the Turpin children. First, let me begin with, while we don't know the particulars of the neighborhoods the family lived in, the Turpins lived in three different places for several years, and they had neighbors in all of these places. Neighbors that told the police that they had noticed that there were children there that never left the home. They only left at night, and when they did, the neighbors said that the children looked extremely frail. They thought something was very wrong and something was off, but they didn't want to get involved and they didn't alert the authorities.
Okay. If you see something, say something, right? That's what we should all be doing.
There's always this fear of interference, but when I hear the descriptions, when you know that there's these children living, their shades are drawn, they're not coming out, you've seen them rarely and they're looking frail, it's a phone call. It's just a phone call for a welfare check.
It could be an anonymous phone call.
In fact, it could be anonymous. So I do feel that it would have been nice for someone to, I feel that it was an obligation someone should have called. Now, the Turpins' own extended family shared similar information with the police. Remember, I referenced them earlier, stating, several members of them stating that Louise and David had cut off contact years ago and would not allow them to visit the children. However, before all contact was cut off, they had noticed the children were extremely skinny and were not allowed to leave the home. They thought David and Louise were just super strict, but nobody in the family thought to alert the authorities as well. Again, they saw something of concern, but did not interfere.
Yes.
I'm not blaming these people, by the way, for the abuse. They're not directly responsible. But there were any number of points at which someone could have intervened to possibly help these children.
Yeah. And worst case scenario, you call in a tip and everything's fine, right?
Exactly.
Wouldn't we rather that happen?
Every time. Now, Jennifer Turpin attended grade school and some of her siblings. She talked about how dirty she was. She talked about how her classmates would not sit near her. If her classmates would not sit near her, and by the way, her classmates later went on the record saying they remembered her and felt badly about how they treated her. Don't you think the teachers noticed?
They should have.
And no teachers ever alerted the authorities as to her condition as well. Okay, so this is another person in authority who could have intervened. Mm. The school system in California never checked on a home school called Sandcastle Day School, where all of the children, you asked earlier, were being schooled by Principal David Turpin and teacher Louise Turpin, according to the papers filed by David and Louise. Now, I don't know all the requirements, but I did some searching and found the requirements for homeschooling in California are not restrictive and do not require much proof of schooling at all. Some have referred to this phenomena as educational neglect. Mm-hmm. I will reserve any opinions upon that as I'm not in the field. But I will say that some required verifications of the children over the years would have certainly raised red flags.
Yes.
Some regulations.
Yes.
So again, now the school system is failing them. Speaking of which, after they were rescued and cared for by the hospital, the youngest Turpin children were placed in an abusive home where they were re-victimized. They were abandoned by social services, expected to function the adult children without assistance in a world where they didn't know anything really or have any skills. So what I'm saying is I think that the system, every system, all of the institutions in our society failed this family.
Yeah, there's got to be a way to weigh personal liberty with protection of children. Like, you know, there's got to be some way that we could better protect children that just somehow fly under the radar like this.
Yeah, this is a case where it really does make you think, like, what's the better way? Where is it? Where's the crack? The cracks were in every stage, though, here.
Yeah.
Every single stage.
Did she have home births or she gave birth to all these children in the hospital?
That I don't know.
I'm wondering.
But even so, the problem did not seem to originate at birth. It was after they got home behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
Despite it all, the Turpin children are making their way, focusing on the path forward while preserving their sibling bonds and their love for one another. We sincerely hope all of the Turpin children receive the support and the support they need and deserve as they move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I really hope that these agencies who are, quote, investigating come up with some very tangible results, outcomes, and ways to help these children and take responsibility for any of their own failures.
Yes, and all the children, even the adult children, need support and they all need to be, you know, yes, they need financial, they need help to be able to thrive financially, but they need a lot more than that. And they need to be given the services that they've missed out on all those years.
And we owe it to them. As a society, we owe them this help. As a public service announcement here, I just want to say, because we said, if you do see something, if you suspect child abuse, if anyone suspects child abuse is possible, the Child Help National Child Abuse Hotline provides state-specific information on how and where to report suspected child maltreatment. So anyone can call Child Help 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, via a toll-free number. That's 1-800-4-A-CHILD or 422-4453. So I just wanted to leave on that note because there is an easy way to raise a red flag if you have suspicions.
Is there still a way to donate to the children?
You know, I looked about the donations and I couldn't find one. So J.C. Duggar did have, she did raise money for them. And I believe that's part of the trust, though.
Mm-hmm.
But she no longer actively raises money for them. It's back to her institution. So I couldn't find a direct way to donate. But if somebody else does, please let me know because we'd be happy to publish that information.
Yes. Thank you so much for this case, Megan.
Yeah, I know. It was a heartbreaking one, but I think it's really, really important. It helps shed light on an issue that we don't always see and reminds us to pay attention.
Yep.
And on that note, Amy, before we leave today, I believe that we have a question from a supporter.
Yes, we do have one question for today. The question is, should I do a PhD in criminology, criminal justice, or forensic psychology? Megan, if you don't mind, I'll take this one.
Go for it.
Okay. I think the answer to that is going to lie with the person asking the question, because it really depends on what you want to do and what you're interested in. Now, what I can tell you is that if you get a PhD in criminology or a PhD in criminal justice, you can essentially go get the same kind of jobs. It really depends on what you focus on, what methodology you use in your dissertation. Even on the undergraduate level, we offer a criminology degree and a criminal justice degree. And I often tell students, don't get so hung up on the terminology. If you're interested in the area, see which campus works better for you, which classes seem better for you. But criminal justice essentially is the study of police, courts, and corrections. Criminology is the study of why people commit crime. However, you can't have one without the other. They work very closely. And if you're looking for a job in the field, a job that has a requirement of a PhD in criminology will accept PhD in criminal justice and vice versa. Now, forensic psychology is a bit different. Forensic psychology has two tracks. It's a clinical track where an individual is interested in doing assessments for the courts, insanity evaluations, becoming an expert witness. It's a clinician. So you're going to school for a PhD, but you're going to act as a clinician in some sort of capacity. Some forensic psychologists will work in private practice with people who are justice involved. The other track is often experimental forensic psychology. And those are people that go to study more, it's more of the research side of things. For example, you might study jury decision-making, eyewitness identification. It's looking at the process, the psychological processes that are relevant to the law. I can go on and on. These are my favorite things to talk about. I have my master's in forensic psychology, and I was very much debating on whether to get a PhD in forensic psychology or criminology / criminal justice. So I gave this a lot of thought. I think at the end of the day, it depends where you do an internship, what you write your dissertation on, and the connections you make while you're in graduate school. Megan, do you have anything to add there?
No, I think you said it perfectly. Just what your real interest lies in doing afterwards as well, whether you, because I think forensic psychology does imply that you could be a clinician, and criminal justice and criminology, not exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. All right. Thank you so much for that question. And Megan, thank you again for such an important episode. I really learned a lot today, and I hope that our listeners will say something if they see something.
Thank you so much to our listeners for joining us today, and we'll see you next time on Women in Crime. Women in Crime is written and hosted by Megan Sachs and Amy Schlossberg. Our producer is James Varga. Script editing is by Abigail Belcastro. Audio editing is by Siler Burr and Jose Alfonso, and music is by Desert Media. If you enjoy the show, please remember to follow and leave a review. You can also support the show through Patreon, where you can get access to additional ad-free content such as exclusive full-length episodes, lectures, a book club, and virtual happy hours with Megan and Amy. For more information, visit patreon.com/womenandcrime. Sources for today's episode include a 2020 special with Diane Sawyer, Investigative Discovery Crime Feed, The New York Post, CBS News, and The Business Insider.